A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number six.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 24. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of The Omega Factor. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon in England.
There was some controversy surrounding The Omega Factor, this paranormal TV series from 1979. And in particular, most of it happened around episode 5, which was called The Powers of Darkness. It dealt with a young woman who is apparently sensitive to psychic phenomena of some type and was possessed or contacted by the spirit of a 16th century witch. And the episode started with a séance in that the contact was made between this young woman and this spirit of a witch from 16th century Scotland, which played on some real stories of people burning witches and the like in Scotland. And burning was definitely a part of it, because the burning of this witch whose spirit was involved was a theme here. And there was a sequence that involved someone else who was picking up on this through the young woman, who believed he was being burned at the stake and had these attacks of various sorts. And there was one scene where he actually spontaneously combusts, and they included images of this man on fire. That was a pretty dramatic image, and that met with some criticism that they showed a person burning to death. You didn't see burning flesh or anything like that, but you saw a man walk into the room with enormous flames rising off him.
And we've got, as you say, we've got this young student who's apparently possessed, and we've got seances, and we've got Ouija boards, and we've got Tom and Anne investigating what's going on. And it all builds up to a scene in a church, which I think is an abandoned church they end up in. And the young woman, they interrupt her in the middle of some ritual that she's about to perform. And it involves, there's a dead bird on the altar and there's a knife. It's all quite creepy stuff. And Tom has to use his own psychic powers to sort of get inside her mind and try and free her from this possession. And then we get this sequence. I don't know, I suppose it's in the psychic landscape of her mind, where we have Tom and a demonic character wrestling for this young woman.
I loved that sequence. It was very abstract, of this sort of all black space or room that these people wearing all black were standing in, with very modern 20th century sounding string music playing, and people grasping at each other's shoulders and pulling them in one direction or the other. It was very abstract. Some of the crew working on it in the commentary referred to it as Eric's ballet. It was quite unusual.
Yes, it's all very symbolic stuff. We've got the three actors or three characters in black bodysuits on a black set with no dialogue. And there's this sort of symbolic pulling the young woman backwards and forwards between them. I have to say that perhaps because I'd had the experience of being forced to go and see friends doing interpretive dance and mime in the 1970s, I was less impressed by this scene. To me, it did seem, as you say, it's a very sort of modern dance mime scene, which is a bit weird.
That's fair enough. It had been referred to as the most abstract thing you were likely to see on the BBC.
Absolutely, yes. It caught me by surprise, this particular scene, but it also caught someone else by surprise.
Yes, and here we once again get back to Mary Whitehouse, who we've mentioned before on British Invaders. She founded this National Viewers and Listeners Association and was a sort of self-appointed watchdog or guardian to see that nothing too scary or too controversial showed up in television and radio programs, a sort of moral police, a little bit strange. And she campaigned against Doctor Who with some of their scarier things that happen, that they shouldn't be broadcasting these things during the early evening or during the afternoon. She was involved in things with Robin of Sherwood, campaigning against some of the things in that. And when The Omega Factor was broadcast, particularly when episode 5, The Powers of Darkness, was broadcast. She was quite incensed. There was an exchange of letters. She wrote letters to the BBC calling it evil, complaining about the desecration of a church and a seance and all of these things that she considered to be quite unacceptable for broadcast, or at least for broadcast before 9 o'clock in the evening. This was broadcast at 8:10. So a number of these things were actually broadcast just before 9 o'clock. The events in the church, for example, and the climax and many of these things would have been, I would think, only minutes before 9 o'clock.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, she is a significant figure in British television because, as you say, she was a self-appointed moral police officer who caused all sorts of fuss throughout the 60s, 70s and 80s. I suspect, well, I mean, we've heard this on DVDs and interviews, that some of the Doctor Who production staff almost regarded it as a challenge, and they felt that if they hadn't had a letter of complaint from Mary Whitehouse, they weren't doing their job properly. So she was in some respects a figure of fun, but she certainly saw no fun at all in The Omega Factor and Powers of Darkness, Episode 5, which, as you say, went out in this slot, 8:10, which they'd inherited. And I think that's part of the problem. I think they'd inherited the slot in the schedule from a show that was about a newspaper office, The Standard. They went with this paranormal, spooky show. And as you say, she protested about seances, she protested about the church scene, and she protested about the man on fire. And as you say, it went on to a reasonably sort of controversial and notorious exchange of letters between her and the BBC.
Yes, the sequence with the burning man, the man on fire, was certainly one that had a lot of controversy to it that was sparked by Mary Whitehouse. And probably if they had been setting it up initially with this series rather than inheriting a time slot, it probably would have had maybe a 9 o'clock or a 9:10 time slot. And that would have put it in something of a different situation.
The 9 o'clock watershed is interesting, or I find it interesting, because we now have this accepted concept that there was a 9 o'clock, or that there is a 9 o'clock watershed, and that after that you can show things that are perhaps not suitable or appropriate for before 9 o'clock. But I'm curious to know when that became the accepted cutoff in Britain, which I haven't been able to find any details about. So I'm not sure whether in 1979 that the 9 o'clock cutoff would have been so well recognised as it is now. And perhaps, I mean, if anybody who's listening knows when the watershed became firmly introduced in British TV, they could let me know. They could email the programme.
Yes, I'm not sure about that. I think there was a smaller separation at 8 o'clock as well, that what you could do before and after 8 o'clock was different. But certainly you hear about 9 o'clock, and I'm not sure where that came from or who defined it.
No. Anyway, I think, unfortunately, the BBC found themselves on a losing wicket on this particular argument, because it turned out, I think particularly with the Man on Fire sequence, that they had breached their own in-house guidelines on violence in television programmes. I think as the ratings for The Omega Factor were not doing terribly well at this point, the combination of the two things, the controversy from Mary Whitehouse and the ratings started to slip, meant that, unfortunately, The Omega Factor as a series was probably doomed.
That's right. It completed its original season, its original 10-episode run, and that was it. It was never continued.
Yeah, the BBC felt it wasn't doing terribly well, plus they were receiving some heat and flack from protesters, and they probably thought this was not one to fight on, and they would just let it slip away, which is, of course, exactly what they did.
Jenny? Can you hear me?
Keep away from me. Keep away from me, you fiend. I know you, evil one. Let me be.
Was she like this when you got here?
Yes. She's convinced she's a 16th century witch about to be burnt at the stake. She's doing some strange things. Creating images. Weird.
Creating them for you?
Yes. At least I hope to God they were images.
You've been able to lock into her mind?
Well, I suppose so. She's been able to lock into mine. Either way, it wasn't funny.
We've got to help her.
Now, you may be thinking, if you've not seen The Omega Factor and you're hearing our description, this all sounds very familiar. And hang on, wasn't this called The X-Files? In a sort of strange way, The Omega Factor was a very much a spiritual predecessor to The X-Files, which would turn up on screens 15 or 20 years later. I mean, obviously, we've got this very similar subject matter of investigating paranormal events, and we have our two main characters, the male character who's a believer, although he has his sceptical moments, but he wants to believe, and then we have the female character who's, in fact, redheaded, a redheaded female character who's scientific and sceptical. And it does sound, you know, in places very much like the program that was going to come along in America, The X-Files.
Especially because it has these major conspiracy elements to it as well.
Absolutely. We've got their boss, who we're never quite sure exactly which side he's on. He seems conflicted. We've got the conspiracy. We've got the shadowy Deep Throat character who pops up from time to time. And of course, in The X-Files, there was a character called Deep Throat who did just that, who appeared to be working for the government and would crop up from time to time to give Fox Mulder information. And I mean, to continue with the theme, in some episodes, we get slideshow briefings at the start of the episode, just like in an episode of The X-Files. And Anne Reynolds, in one episode, is abducted. And of course, Scully was famously abducted in The X-Files. And when you watch the sequence with Anne Reynolds wearing a white robe in a white room, lying on a couch, that scene turned up in The X-Files almost exactly the same.
It is a strange set of things to be in common. They do have a lot that seems to connect them.
Yes, I mean, if you're a fan of The X-Files, if you've watched The X-Files first, and then you come back to The Omega Factor and watch this show, you'll be thinking, well, they did this in The X-Files. But here it is on British TV in 1979. And yeah, I can't think that Chris Carter, the creator of The X-Files, or any of his crew can have seen The Omega Factor. It wasn't widely distributed. It just had these 10 episodes on British television in 1979.
Yeah, The Omega Factor did gain this sort of cult classic status and had relatively small but dedicated group of fans, and it became something of a legend, you know, having this legendary status to fans of paranormal TV, that there was this British TV series in the 70s that so many people just hadn't seen, because if you missed the original one or you didn't know about it until after the original airing, it was just unavailable for so many years. So it did gain some legendary status that way, and people had been talking about these connections and how it related to The X-Files and all these other things through this whole long time period where it just wasn't available.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the fact that it wasn't available, you know, it had a small but very vocal group of fans who discussed it, and particularly discussed it when The X-Files came out. And I think plus the fact that we knew that the show had been controversial and had been possibly taken off the air because of some disturbing images and disturbing episodes. And of course, anything that we can't see in a way, either because it's been banned or because it's been lost or it's just not available, becomes that much more mysterious and alluring to us, doesn't it? You know, we're fascinated to find out what the fuss was about.
That's right. There is definitely something like that that has happened with many of the lost episodes of Doctor Who. You know, many of these 1960s Doctor Who TV serials are no longer in the archive. You can't see them at all. You can only get audio. For many years, it wasn't easy to get audio copies either. So the people who remembered them talked about them a lot. And you had these missing episodes that, because they were missing, were the great classics of Doctor Who. And then in some cases, when the episodes were rediscovered, we'd be able to see them and realize that maybe they were good, but they weren't quite up to what had been built up for them.
If we can't see it, it does build a reputation. So we should talk about the good and the bad of The Omega Factor, what we liked and perhaps what parts we felt didn't work quite so well. I mean, certainly I found the first four episodes were very gripping. I mean, I think the first episode is fantastic and has a very genuine sense of spookiness and menace and unpleasantness. So that works very well.
Yes, that certainly worked well. I also particularly liked the acting in this series. You had a number of classically trained actors and Shakespearean actors. James Hazeldine, who played Tom Crane, went on to play in the Royal Shakespeare Company. And John Carlyle had already, beforehand, had played in the Royal Shakespeare Company. Cyril Luckham, who was Drexel, was also a Shakespearean actor. So you had a number of these really classically trained actors who were really giving these good, committed, solid performances. And that was something that I really enjoyed from end to end in this series.
The lead performances are great. I mean, as you say, they're totally committed to it. Some of the smaller roles, perhaps, you know, not quite so good, but the lead roles, the lead performances are very good. I mean, James Hazeldine, sadly, is no longer with us because he died tragically young a couple of years ago. As you say, he'd been a Shakespearean actor, but he'd also been in long-running British TV shows like London's Burning, which is a show about firefighters. And he was in a show called The Last Train, a post-apocalyptic TV show, which had a different title in North America, which escapes me at the moment. So the performances were great, and the setting in Edinburgh was fantastic. I like that. And the villain, Drexel, is a very powerful villain. I mean, he works very well. And whenever he's in an episode, it sort of raises the tension and the intensity.
Yes, Cyril Luckham brought something to that in that role that was very nice. I also quite enjoyed these ongoing story arcs, the ambiguity of the Omega conspiracy and dealing with this recurring villain, Edward Drexel, sort of builds up into this mysterious conspiracy that had Drexel involved, but we don't know who else is involved, and there's so much that we don't know that it builds up to, and the whole idea of Tom Crane being disbelieved, where Tom Crane says, yes, there's this conspiracy working against us, and no one else believes him. And there were other minor arcs in there that I liked as well, but I thought that was quite good.
The mystery of what happens to Tom Crane's brother is quite interesting. As you say, that goes on for several episodes.
Yes. It also had some very dark and moody lighting to it, and the staging was done in a way that was very stylistic and well set up. This was something that this team at BBC Scotland, who got quite involved in this story, really set something up that went the extra mile in setting up the feel for it. In particular, the music. This score was written and conducted by Anthony Isaac. It was a really nice score with lots of strings in there that really built up the tension. And it had music written specifically for each episode. Although many themes and things were reused, they did record for each episode. It was all recorded on one day, which I thought worked quite well. A lot of it doesn't have music and it's used quite sparsely, but I found it worked very well.
Okay. There is the stuff that perhaps doesn't work so well in the series. And as you may have gathered, I have...
Some issues?
I have some issues. Yes, Brian, I have some issues. I have some issues as the show continues. I think the first four episodes are very interesting and fascinating. I think when we get to the fifth episode, which I was less impressed by, I thought they certainly started to lose my attention after the fourth episode, and I think the show started to waver slightly. They do finish off one fairly major plot line fairly early on. I'm all for getting resolutions to things, but actually I thought they finished that too early, and I would have preferred to have seen that continue, because that was keeping me interested.
In some ways they may have. They had this plot line with Edward Drexel, and then the plot line with the Omega conspiracy, and the two of them probably should have been mingled a little bit more than they were.
Yes, they should have kept those together a bit longer.
Yes. As for how it continues, in some ways, I like the continuation because I liked how the Omega conspiracy sort of built up. But of course, as you start building up that new plot line, some of the other things slow down in order to do that. So I can see the issues with that as well.
And then when we get to Powers of Darkness, I had exactly the problem that you've already described, that when you know something's not been available and it's been controversial, one possible outcome when you finally get to see it might be disappointment. And that was my outcome. I wondered what some of the fuss had been about when I finally watched episode 5. But there you go, that was probably because I'd built it up too much. I'd read all about it before I finally got to see it.
Well, it was also of its time.
Yes.
And the things that were in that were controversial would not be controversial now. The famous scene with the person on fire was pretty good. It was dramatic, but it was fairly mild by our standards now, I would think. You basically see someone come in with his clothing on fire and then he falls to the floor. There isn't much more than that. At the time, the idea of seeing someone on fire was very controversial, where what you actually saw was dramatic, but it was not, I would say, in any way graphic.
No. But it certainly caused a fuss at the time, didn't it? And as you say, it's perhaps of its time, really, 1979. I must admit, I was also... The characters do seem to spend quite some time behaving like people did in the 1970s, where they will sit around in their flats and listen to music.
Yes.
There's a fair bit of Pink Floyd going on.
Yeah, they had this thing they built up about what the different preferences for music that different characters had. It was definitely of its time.
Yes.
You had that type of focus. You had Tom wearing lots of polyester shirts wide open at the collar and Anne's very large glasses and so on.
The 70s fashions.
Yeah, 70s fashions and 70s pacing for sure. The effects are kind of an interesting thing because they would sometimes try to do these sort of graphical effects with blue screen and other techniques They probably looked okay at the time, but they don't look so great now. I don't think they even looked that great at the time. And they definitely sort of stick out, and it's just something you have to live with.
Some of the creepy effects that they try, that you really feel that they should actually have left the effect off altogether, and that the scene would have been more scary and powerful without it. I'm thinking of one scene where there's a character who's apparently been possessed. He's threatening, and it's quite scary and intense, and they signify that he's been possessed by doing a very sort of strange overlay red effect on his eyes, and it just looks terrible.
That was one of the most obvious ones, for sure.
Yes. And of course, you know, if they hadn't bothered with that, the scene would, I think, would have been much more powerful, because the actor was doing a reasonable job. And then he has these sort of almost as if somebody's gone through the videotape with a red felt pen and colored in his eyes. And it's...
That's right. On the other hand, there actually were a number of places where they did some very simple effects using just superimposition of images and crossfades of one image to another, and just very simple things that they could do that don't look especially different to what a crossfade or a superimposition looks like now. I thought some of those looked quite good. There were some of those in the first episode, actually. I was impressed with the tension they could get into their stories using the actors, using some of those very simple effects, and using the music and the lighting. They were able to get some very intense climaxes.
As you say, that bit works well. In the first episode, which is, I think, fantastic, the sequence, which I've already mentioned, where Tom and Anne are trying to find a missing woman. And they've got two things going on. You've got this fantastic Edinburgh architecture, and then you've got, as you say, you've got the crossfades and the effects, and it's tremendously effective. If they'd stuck to that, I think it would have been far more successful.
Yeah, they used those types of things on a number of occasions, and I've always enjoyed them.
Working for another master.
Who?
I don't know. Could be anyone.
I told you I knew nothing about that wig you found in my flat. Don't you believe me?
Did you believe me when I said those pills weren't mine?
Tom. This is awful. Now we're suspecting each other.
Maybe somebody planted them to make us do just that.
For what reason?
So, availability of the Omega Factor. As you've gathered, it is now available, and it came out in, I think, 2005, 2006. It finally, the fans got what they'd been asking for. They got a box set release of the DVDs, of the 10 episodes, which is available in both Regions 1 and Region 2. And it's also available, I think, in all the major sort of online rental DVD outlets. And there's some extra features on the DVD. There's a documentary about making the Omega Factor, including some of the recollections of the various spooky occurrences that happened during the production. And there's some, I think there's some commentaries on some of the episodes, which you've listened to, Brian.
Yes, there's one commentary, and that's on Powers of Darkness, Episode 5.
Oh, right.
Talking about some of the controversy, reading parts of the letter from Mary Whitehouse, and talking about a number of other things as well. They had, I believe, a writer, a producer, and a director on there. This is one of those things that finally there is a release after so many years of it not being available at all, you know, 25 years or more. Finally, there is this release and we're able to see the Omega Factor.
So our recommendations, or shall I go first?
I think you better go first on this one, Eamon.
I think that you should watch the first four episodes and decide what you think about the Omega Factor and whether you want to continue from there. I think you should also watch the fifth episode. And then what I suggest is email British Invaders and tell me why I'm wrong about the fifth episode and why Brian is right. That would be my recommendation. And if you do it through Netflix or Amazon Rental, then you can get the first disc, which I think has the first three or four episodes, almost as a taster, and see what you think.
This is a series that, as you might gather, I enjoy a lot. I only came across this fairly recently after the DVDs came out. I think it's a very good series. I would recommend it as an interesting exploration into these different paranormal ideas. And if you like a series that takes a nice, serious examination of something and turns it over, then this is pretty good. Yeah, it has some dated effects and dated pacing. On the whole, I quite like it. I enjoyed the conspiracy aspects. I enjoyed the paranormal aspects. and the way they treated it and how the actors dealt with it. So I would recommend this as a fun little 10-episode sort of dark, serious examination of this type of thing.
I would say do watch it, and I would be fascinated to know what people think. I'd be fascinated to get some emails about The Omega Factor, and in particular, as I say, email and tell me why I'm wrong about episode 5.
Or if you like, tell us why Eamon is right about episode 5, and I'm wrong about episode 5, if you happen to feel that way. Yeah, if we do get a whole bunch of emails on this, that would be great, and maybe we'll even compile something from it and post that.
Or pop it on the blog. Put it in the comments on the show blog.
Sure, absolutely. And if you remember The Omega Factor from when it came out in 79, all the better. Tell us about that. So, in summary, The Omega Factor was a 10-episode 1979 series that dealt with the paranormal and unexplained phenomena as Tom Crane and Ann Reynolds investigated and found out information about these various things. It also went into conspiracy ideas and had a dark take on things and took its subject matter very seriously. And I think that covers it for our discussion of The Omega Factor. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. In our next pair of episodes, we will be talking about Gormenghast, which was a 2000 BBC TV miniseries that was a fantasy based on Mervyn Peake's series of novels by the same name. So until then, this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And this is Eamon from England, saying that the truth is still out there.